Blog Talk Radio.
This is Cindy S. Solomon coming to you live with the Global Product Management Talk. I am delighted to be with you today on March 26th, my time, in the San Francisco Bay Area. Today we have Lynn Randall discussing issues of the evolution of communication. Also today, our co-hosts, both Adrian Tan and Nick Koster of BrainMate, with us from Sydney, Australia.
Hello, how are you?
Hi, everyone.
The Global Product Management Talk is curated for passionate product professionals and business owners who want to teach, learn, and network about managing products, including agile practitioners involved with developing, designing, and launching products, brands, marketing, project management, and everyone who cares about the entire product management lifecycle process to guarantee successful products and companies. The Global Product Management Talk raises the bar for what is possible to accomplish in a real-time open platform event by encouraging participants to expand their knowledge base with each event, utilize new products in real-time as we introduce and beta test various products for participating, enable participants to showcase their knowledge and share resources with their tweets, and crowdsource educational content for product people to stay apprised of new developments, thinkers, and events in the practice of managing products from inception to market and innovation. Today we are brought to you by the AIPMM, the Association of International Product Marketing and Management, which was founded in 1998, and promotes worldwide excellence in product management education and provides value to individual members, corporate members, and sponsors through training, education, certification, and professional networking opportunities. There is a webinar this Friday, March 30th, with Brian Lawley on how to advance your product management career and be a phenomenal product manager. Please visit the AIPMM.com for more information. Today we are discussing the evolution of communication. Our speaker, Lynn Randall, is a managing partner with Randall Insights, LLC. And she has written about how our brains are devolving back to the time of hieroglyphics in reaction to information overload. The human brain is rapidly changing and reshaping as a result of the Internet. Human socialization is undergoing such a rapid evolution that we can no longer see it happening. Those of us who develop content to engage participation know this all too well because the old methods have failed. We've experimented and changed our approaches. The tools we now must use to communicate to reach our target audiences have become much more sophisticated. Product marketers must construct relevant and compelling messages about product benefits and values or fail, and product managers who can incorporate customer behavior into the design features and overall function of the product will create users that love the product. Our speaker, Lynn Randall, is passionate about helping her clients improve the performance of their content, meetings, and events. Her consulting practice has included all aspects of content strategy and development, event design, implementation, and measurement, with special emphasis on cooking up the right recipe of virtual solutions to enhance a physical event, applying the lessons of neuroscience and macroergonomics to supercharge engagement, and extracting the story from event data to provide a blueprint for action. Thank you for joining us, Lynn.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's such a pleasure to join this group and, of course, share a topic that my nerdly side, which is pretty much my entire person, has very much gotten into, not only as it relates to business, but also just personally learning more about the brain and how we function and the changes that we are in the midst of right now, which you referenced in your intro, which I think we're in one of these unprecedented periods in time where we're later going to see. It's not like the Industrial Revolution created changes in the way that we did things and received products, et cetera. I think that this period in time is really a social revolution that will probably be about the same in terms of impact. We just can't see possibly how we are all changing as humans because it's happening and we're in the midst of it. Does that make sense?
Exactly. Even as we speak, what's happening in this conversation where BrainMates, Adrian and Nick, I've developed a close relationship with over the past year that we're collaborating together on this talk, and we've yet to meet face-to-face, and I've learned so much from them, and I do feel like we're in the same room, even though I'm across the bay from San Francisco, and they're in Sydney, Australia, 7,400 miles away.
Yeah, it's very fascinating. There's actually a neuroscientist by the name of Paul Zak did a study where he drew blood and measured the chemicals that are created in the brain and found that exactly what you just described, it's the same experience. Your brain processes this kind of online connection exactly the same as if it were a real physical connection. It's the whole oxytocin link. Paul Zak did an article for a Fast company called Dr. Love, because oxytocin is the cuddle chemical, the love chemical, makes us feel good, feel safe, etc. Well, how interesting and awesome that what he was able to find is that we can create these bonds. And
Lynn's talk is really topical for us at the moment, because our team's just recently done some training with a guy who's written a book on neuroscience and neurosegmentation. So we're trying to learn this new, I won't say method, but new way of thinking to try and figure out how we incorporate some of it in product development.
Yes, so it really speaks to the whole design thinking, and where it's almost that we all have to be user experience experts.
I think it's more than design thinking and more than user experience. It's looking beyond that and trying to figure out how do humans generally think and going back to the base. And I think if we can incorporate some of that, then be subsequently the experience and the design that we produce would hopefully be more compelling.
Right, or at least more intuitive. Originally, software, technology, hardware, it was developed by engineers who weren't thinking with that side of the brain, and they weren't observing how people related to products. They were building things that they enjoyed building and what they wanted. They were solving problems that were problems for them.
Yep.
And flips, since technology has really become consumer, everything is consumer facing. Even B2B products are recognizing that who is using them are human beings.
Yeah, absolutely. Human beings with lives and emotions. Yeah.
Right. So, thank you, Nick. I see that you've posted how is the way you communicate different now than it was 5 years ago.
And yep, just trying to keep up.
Thank you. John Newbery had answered it.
Oh my goodness, how do we communicate differently now than 5 years ago? Well, I think this is a good example of it. And Twitter is one way that we communicate that we hadn't used about 5-6 years ago.
I think probably the biggest difference is that we have both synchronous and asynchronous communication. Before, the only way we talk to people either be by, you know, very slow email communications, but now we can send a message to people and kind of leave it waiting for them, like Twitter. It doesn't have to be real time, but yet we still have that real-time feel about it because it can happen very quickly. It's less interruptive as a result of that.
In terms of the way that we communicate, it's also all pervasive. It happens all the time. There is no time where it doesn't happen. We're on our mobile phones, computers, iPads.
Mm, that's also true. So I guess with the rise of the smartphone, the permanently connected pocket, I guess, is also changing the way we interact, whether it's a Facebook update or a Twitter notification or a phone call or a text message. All of these things are all the time.
There is a phone number, 323-927-2957, and you can call in and get into the conference with us. This is another feature that we do have available. Now, that is not ringing here. That's ringing.
Oh, no. That's our office. Sorry. It's a circus today.
It's a demonstration of how communication has changed.
Absolutely. There's phones. It's happening everywhere. People jumping in and out of meetings around me. But I'm still here.
If we can't connect online, we still have a phone line. Hello.
Hello, I am back.
Lynn.
Everybody's back.
Yay, so now I have Lynn on the phone with us, and I have Adrian and Nick over Skype. We're all online, and no one's tweeting.
Yes, we were talking. We forgot to tweet.
So I believe you were answering Q1, and we are demonstrating how communication has changed in the past year alone. We started doing this, before I figured out we could record over Skype. So even that is just in the past year, and I've only been using Skype since I started talking to you, Adrian.
Yeah, me too. Although I do talk to the guys at Rymer over Skype.
Well, since then, I now talk with everyone over Skype, so it's my preferred audio communication. So, Lynn, welcome back.
Thanks. Thanks for being patient with me.
What happens? We're all used to this. Someone was saying that how you know whether a product works or not is when it breaks down. And that's how you really get what the user experience is, when things are broken and if they can intuit how to fix it or whether they get frustrated and never come back to your product again.
Well, exactly. Correct, which certainly this being a demonstration of that, right? It's always good to have backup like this.
Question two is, how do you see the way that your children communicate different now than children did 5 years ago? And I think this is essential for parents. I find that I'm not sure that people who don't have children are recognizing that.
Well, yeah, this is probably true because there is this huge difference between what we find to be comfortable in terms of our communication and the way that our kids are now communicating. So one of the things that I have seen is that my 14-year-old daughter and I, when I was her age, we had one phone with a cord in our kitchen. My parents might have added a second line in their bedroom at some point before I left for college. I'd sneak into the kitchen after they went to bed and have these long conversations with whatever the boy was that I had a crush on at that time. We talked for hours. Well, my daughter doesn't talk on her phone. She has a cell phone, first of all, so she doesn't have to be in a central area where everyone can hear her. But no one hears her at all because she doesn't talk on the phone. She spends hours and hours texting with her friends, tens of thousands of texts every month. So if there's a boy that she's interested in, she'll break up with them on text, or she'll start quote-unquote seeing them on text or Facebook and or Twitter. That level of communication that we had on the telephone doesn't occur anymore. Kids just don't relate in that way. The other thing that I think is true, and this is not just with kids, but probably more comfortable for people below a certain age, if you will, and that is the communal nature of experiences and how these social and online tools are playing a huge role in this change. So the example that I've been using lately is broadcast television. If you're like my family, you DVR everything to skip through the commercials. But what networks have done that I think is completely brilliant is that they've added a live Twitter feed for their show. Everything from the Oscars, the Super Bowl, Dancing with the Stars, The Voice, even Dance Mom promote their Twitter hashtags so that there's live tweeting, and we want to share these experiences at the same time as another group of people. We want to know what they're thinking and if they're seeing and thinking the same things we are. We'll sit in our living room, and my daughter will be on her phone or on our iPad checking out the tweets related to whatever the show is that we're watching. We're not necessarily talking on the couch, but we're all looking at what's going on the Twitter feed or that hashtag for that particular show because they want to share that with others, even Facebook. So her friends will post things. Did you see Dance Mom? Can you believe so-and-so? You know?
So we're all communicating more, but talking less.
Very true. That's an excellent way to thank you, Adrian. Communicating more, talking less is the big trend, with the younger set. There was also an interesting blog post on Scientific American that talked about our ability to produce data, so all of this information that's out there, really outstripping our ability to understand it. We've got all of this information that's coming at us, communication information. There's so much of it that we can't really process it anymore. There is this discipline, or a new discipline that's coming up that I think will be big for our kids, again, our children's generation, and that has to do with data mining, the process of analyzing all of this information and data that's coming in, shaping it into something that is a useful little diamond of information. And I think that these are skills that didn't even cross the minds of our generation when we were in college and considering what fields that we wanted to go into. But I think with the speed of processing and internet and online tools, that requirement is just going to continue to grow and ramp up.
By the way, this is also a Twitter chat. We use the hashtag #PODMGMTTALK to answer questions and communicate on Twitter. There are several people in the room talking with us, including Kelly Burrows and John Newberry, as well as Hague Tweet, Steve Haas, and a few people were tweeting earlier. Kelly Burrows, I believe, is listening. Hello, Kelly. Do you think the increase in communication channels can result in too much unfiltered information for us to deal with?
Absolutely, it does. And it relates to the way that our brains are changing. So there was a long time where we human beings believed that our brains were sort of set by a certain age. And it was the reason that we came up with sayings such as, you can't teach an old dog new tricks, things like that. The reality is, in more recent years, neuroscientists have really figured out that our brains are constantly breaking and making new connections, sort of reprogramming. So what they actually call that term is the Google effect on the brain. And it's exactly what Kelly is talking about. It's that, you know, we can't process all of this information, so go out on the internet, we sort of skim through things, check them out, and then only maybe deep dive onto something that is of critical importance to us. But in most cases, we're really not even sticking with that. We just go out and find the information when we need it. And so it's altered the way our brains look for and absorb information and communication. It kind of relates to that question number three, which was, do you find yourself using a search engine to call up information in everyday social conversation? And Adrian and Nick, I don't know, have you found that same phenomenon where you'll whip out your phone and call something up let me look that up.
Yeah, all the time. We have our phones wherever we are watching TV. And, you know, if there's a word, there's something that we don't know, all we do is we look it up. And Google's almost like a folder, if you want, because I rather look for the new information than find it in my existing repository. So I might have the data on my PC, but it's much easier to use Google to find it again. Does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And essentially that's what these researchers have found, is that no one does that anymore. But it used to be what you're describing is actually what they call transactive memory. So if you believe, if humans, people think that you're be able to find that information later, you're not likely to remember it on your own. So there was an experiment around this, and if people felt that they would never be able to or likely to find a piece of information or a fact, or that they might be tested on it, they were like millions of times more likely to remember it. But what they found was that this is something that's kind of always existed. We actually just relied on our friends, our families, our coworkers, and that was our reference material storage facility prior to the internet. So we're really just changing, in a way, that whole transactive memory and how it acts for us. We don't have the time, capacity, or resources to store up all the information we need anymore.
Yeah.
But I guess I'm just wondering whether that's actually something that's changed. If I had a word that came up in a book or that I saw on TV that I didn't know the meaning of, I could just as easily have gone to a dictionary and looked that information up. All that's really changed is the kind of the time delay between the question and finding the answer. And there's no question that's more accessible now, because I can essentially have every dictionary in the world in my pocket. I'm not entirely sure that the habits have changed significantly. Prior to Google and the rise of the internet, if I needed to find a piece of information and I knew where I could find it in some reference material, I would go to that reference material and find the answer. And I certainly agree with the fact that if I don't need to remember something, then the drive to maintain that recall is much lower. But I don't believe that's actually something that's new to the way people find and use information. I think it's really just a change in the convenience factor that's enabled, you know, a lot of these information services to flourish.
Yeah, I'd absolutely agree. I'd say 5 years ago in a business meeting, I might have said something like, well, you know, I'm not sure about that. Let me find out and get back to you. But today, while we're sitting there, I do a search, find what I need, and verify on the spot. So I think it's that access and frequency with which we do look things up. But I think to your point, Nick, it's not something that's a new thing that our brains have suddenly developed this new capability. I think it's actually what it's doing is it altering our ability to take hold of and retain facts in the long term. Because we know we can get it elsewhere. So, you know, when I had to go all the way to a dictionary that might be on a shelf someplace in the other room, or it could take me days to find information, honestly, generally what would happen is by the time I left whatever the meeting was, I'd forget that I was supposed to look it up, and so then it just never happened. So I think that it's aiding the authenticity and the accuracy of these changes that we have because there is so much access. But I also think that there's another piece, at least for me, and I'll give you an anecdote from my life on this. We were out on a friend's boat over the weekend, spring break here, so we had our kids out on a lake in Austin, and we were having this conversation with our friends about our parents and growing up. Now, my friend's dad looks exactly like Martin Scorsese, which is sort of weird because he looks a little like Adam Carolla. Well, my kids.
Hold on, I had to visualize what Martin Scorsese looks like, and he's a character. He's a unique visual.
Exactly.
The eyebrows.
He's got these big glasses. My point with that is it's not always about finding data or information. Sometimes it's about finding images or a video or something that actually enhances or illustrates or supports the conversation that you're having. And I think that's a big change too, is that we have this immediacy of a support for the story that we're telling, or even in a personal setting, we'll use it.
I think it's significant that what you're saying, Lynn, is not only has our behavior changed, but because that change of behavior is altering how our brain is evolving. That is evolution.
Yeah, you're absolutely correct. What happens in the brain is the more often you repeat a thought, an action, anything, the synapses, the connections for that piece of information or action, how to do it, become stronger and stronger and stronger. The less that you use or do or think about something, the weaker those connections become in your brain. And so we're reinforcing by not using, if you will, the same synapses and neurons in our brains and keeping them active on certain things to remember certain pieces. But there's also almost an overload. It's almost too much for us to be able to keep current on and remember. We're going to expand the capacity or use more of our brain power because we're building different sorts of synapses in the brain. Connection lines, if you will. Those neural pathways, I think is actually what it's called.
So we're replacing storage capability with finding capability.
Yes, correct. Accessing and finding. Oh, I know where that is. We don't actually remember. We say, oh, I know where that is, or I know how to find that, right?
Yep.
Okay, most times I don't even know whether I have that data, but at least I know where to go and find it.
I just surround myself with smart people, so if there was a question I had or something I needed fixed, I would go to that person. And now, exactly, I go online. A human expert still surpasses online information if you have the luxury to be surrounded by experts.
Right. If we can just have an entourage of experts follow you around all the time,
right.
Really, that's ideal.
Right. I think that's what my intention is in the product management community, to create these experts so whatever issues arise for a startup or a company in their product management process, I know exactly who to send them to.
But I think that's a really interesting point on the topic we're talking about here, which is in terms of the way we're communicating, that's exactly what we're doing. We're kind of selecting and filtering for our community of experts in the area that we're really passionate about or interested in.
Yep.
And we can do that now without the boundaries of geography.
Correct. Exactly. Exactly correct. So here we are talking to you in Australia, and if I have a question about something that's part of what our conversation has been on this topic, now I know you at all, or can text you or can tweet you or can, you know, almost have immediate access in a form to you as an expert, and that's pretty awesome. That's a change in how we are, not just our brains, but also our socializing, which I think gets to, Cindy, one of the other questions. Is meeting people online first, and you know, how quickly or how do you feel close to them, and how do you build those networks, that kind of network of experts or community of experts?
Exactly. So here's a case in point. This weekend was Product Camp Silicon Valley, where there were 650 people. It's the third time I've been to Product Camp Silicon Valley, and I'm also starting to tour the product camps on the West Coast. But this, by far, Silicon Valley is the biggest product camp, and shout out to Rich Marinoff, who started Product Camp 5 years ago. It is the original Product Camp. So my experience this year was by far more rich and satisfying than in previous years. As a matter of fact, after Product Camp last year, it was so huge, people were starting to question, is there a point at which a product camp gets too big and the value starts diminishing? And now, I think it's because I've spent the year talking with product managers, developing relationships, and when I got there, I knew people, even though I hadn't met them in person, I knew so many people because I've been talking with them. It totally altered my experience, number one, of feeling that there was a community despite how many people were there, and number two, when I met people face-to-face, we didn't start at the beginning. We picked up where we left off in our last online interaction. We could get right into deeper conversations.
Yep, absolutely. Absolutely correct. And the point that this is also something that's an embedded evolutionary trait. So you think about our caveman ancestors, and essentially they wouldn't let strangers into their village. First they realized, oh, well, if we band together, our likelihood of survival is much higher. So this is a good thing for us to build this community. Secondly, when someone new came into our little village, they were maybe evil or could harm our community. So we need to check them out first before we know whether or not they're going to be helpful or harmful to our little community. We build trust from having those common interests, having established trustworthiness. Adrian, you can allow your friend into this village because you vetted them and I trust you, so I trust your friend.
Yeah,
so you can
absolutely.
Let them in.
Yeah.
So these social communities and networks online do that for us. LinkedIn says, Nick also knows Adrian, so I know Nick, trust Nick, I'll be friends with Adrian too. Nick is a secondary connection to me through this network. I think it works in the exact same way as that evolutionary village community. There's also kind of an interesting antidote, and I don't know if I'm going to get it entirely right, but I can find the reference and I'll post it to the Twitter feed. From the World of Warcraft, you know, that online game? The
oh,
World
yes.
of Warcraft?
Yeah.
You may notice this is several years old, but they have these, I don't even know what they call them, I'll call it a tribe, and that's not the right word, but they have these tribes of people that become a team against other warring factions in this game, this online game. And there was a real-world person who was part of one of these tribes who became very sick and died. And no one had met her in person, but they wanted to honor her, memorialize her. So they held a funeral in the online environment for this member of the tribe who had passed away. The warring faction or warring tribe found out about it and attacked in the game all of the people that had come to the funeral and killed them.
Oh my goodness.
So, can you even believe that? So, you know, by the letter of the sort of rules of the game, the opposing faction wasn't doing anything necessarily wrong from the game standpoint, but just from a social moral standpoint, there was so much outrage. But I think that it was just this huge sort of global outrage about that behavior and how terrible it was, because people felt the same online, even though they didn't, you know, they weren't physically together having a funeral, but it felt the same way to be attacked like that, you know? It's a pretty interesting story or anecdote.
Yeah, crazy.
Yeah, but in a way it relates to what we're talking about in terms of connection online versus physical and how close it can feel. It can feel as close, if not closer, from an emotional standpoint.
And maybe we sort of behave differently online because there sometimes may not be the repercussions. I'm just thinking back to your story.
But
you sort of behaved in that way in real life.
Oh, yeah.
You would be in trouble.
Completely socially unacceptable, but online,
I wonder whether that'll change.
I don't know because the anonymity of being online allows people to live out and see people that they aren't in real life, in physical real life. But I wonder with the advent of so much video and the ability to look people up so easily, you know, I get someone's name and I can quickly find out who they are and what they look like, and either through Facebook or LinkedIn or even just Googling. Oftentimes just Googling people, you can find out so much about them. I think that the more we live our lives online in the open, maybe the better we'll behave because of that. The anonymity is going to go away because everybody's going to be able to know who everybody is. So you start to behave in the same way as you would, because I'm like, oh gosh, Adrian can look me up. I'm not going to be a horrible person to her, because she's going to know who I am, and I want her to like me, you know.
Yeah. I don't know. I think you could go the other way as well.
Oh, is that
because
right?
Of that. Because people, you could be someone completely different online, so you can behave badly and there are no repercussions.
Well, so have you seen the documentary Catfish?
No. I've not heard of it.
It's amazing, and I don't want to tell you too much, but it's so right in line with what we're talking about right now. But it's the ability to create whatever persona you want to online is what this documentary is about, and it was just a real life thing that happened. Catfish.
Okay.
These two documentary filmmakers, they were brothers. One guy was being filmed by his brother. They could go through this process of him meeting someone online and becoming, you know, a friend to this family. It's really interesting because, yeah. I can't tell you anymore because I don't want to spoil it for you.
Kelly Burrows is familiar with Catfish, and she's giving a thumbs up.
Ah, okay, good.
So Nick is, I don't hear him talking, but he's tweeting up a storm here.
Yeah.
And he's talking about the issue of trust. He says that the discussion's moving to his favorite topic of trust, which is very hard to digitize, and it changes over time. Trust is created and destroyed by behavior over time because it's harder to establish online, but once it is established, it is the same. Online communications can allow us to create multiple personas depending on the communities that we are engaging with. Yes, so are you saying that that's less and less? Because as we are revealing ourselves and we're forced to use our real names, we have less and less opportunity to hide online. And also that video, you can see someone, that breaks down walls immediately also.
But I think that people behave differently in different situations. So if I go out to have a drink with some friends, I might put on my having a drink with friends persona. If I'm in a board meeting in an office environment, I'll have my very serious business persona played out. And I think the same in our face-to-face lives, that's harder to separate sometimes. But in an online space, it becomes actually quite a lot simpler. People's Facebook profiles often look very, very different to their LinkedIn profile. How they present themselves professionally and privately can easily be siloed off in the online world.
Right, but that was before everything was searchable. I have a different personal Facebook than a professional Facebook because my conversation is different to the different audiences, and then I was told that that's actually against the Facebook rules. But as all of my personas are linking to each other, it's more and more difficult to compartmentalize.
Yeah, I would completely agree, and that I think that that shows up, for example, colleges, even businesses, will now do internet searches for Facebook profiles. What do they look like on Facebook? What do they, to your point, Nick, different personas? How are they showing up in different places? Because you can see online the whole of that person. So that line between professional and personal is blurring since who we are is so readily apparent and available online to anyone who wants to search or seek it out.
But I think that's good. That makes us more human in terms of the benefits of that is that if you go to work, you don't represent multiple people and personalities. You're essentially one person, and I think it's a better, more human way to interact where you're not hiding behind different personas. Through online, you can find out more about everybody. I'm sure some people don't behave in the best light, but that's a different discussion.
Yes, but I think it's true. I think that it's forcing us to become more authentic in all exchanges to who we really are.
Yeah, I like the way you said that, and that's good.
I actually think the other side of that is that if we're always public and all of our personas sort of end up aggregating into one, whether we like it or not, then we can also become a lot more shielded and a lot more guarded. We can never kind of relax and let our guard down and just be ourselves, because our personal life has to be our professional life, has to be our online life as well.
Yeah, I do wonder, Nick, what impact that'll have ultimately on the next generation coming up. My daughter has almost no privacy or security concerns about her personal information, and it makes us completely crazy because we think, why is she putting that out there? Now everyone's going to know this and where she goes to school and et cetera, et cetera. I think that, and I don't know what generation you fall into, but I'm at the very end of the baby boomers. So I'd say I'm in the older crowd in terms of what I think is private and shouldn't be shared or, you know, I mean, there are a fair amount of things that I have concerns about that relate to online security issues and privacy issues. And I believe that with generations coming up, they'll not have our same sort of level of nervousness around that. I think they're putting it all out there and they just don't think about it, or it's a very different, it's one of those evolutionary pieces, I believe.
I like it. I think it's good. I like to be safe.
You're young, Adrian. I can tell.
Absolutely. So not young.
The reality is I'm sort of the same way. I kind of am who I am. And in fact, my Facebook friends, the people that I accept, I have work people and friends I've known for 20 years. And I am that, to your point, Adrian, authentic, what you see is what you get kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. I like that.
Jose Briones agrees with Nick. He says that he finds that there is little overlap amongst his friends and contacts between Facebook, LinkedIn, and Twitter because the interests are different. And he says that he tailors his postings on each network. So he's really thinking of having his content be relevant to the audience in the various communities?
I think what he's touching on is that whole personal branding concept. How do you want people to view you? How do you want to show up in certain lights with certain audiences or individuals? And there's some wisdom to that, absolutely. Nick, do you agree?
Definitely. I mean, we, even at BrainMates, we've struggled with how do we present ourselves across these different social networks. On our LinkedIn group, we have a very professional group of people who talk about product management themes and concepts. And we've only just recently started dabbling with Facebook again. And we're essentially trying to create almost a personal persona of the BrainMates business through that rather than sort of a professional network. So it's kind of, it's a different flavor to the same entity. And I think people treat their own personal profiles the same way.
Jose Briones is saying, I think that a good rule of thumb is that anything you post on the internet will eventually become public, regardless of privacy settings.
Absolutely.
Yep, very true.
I think it's interesting. I use a tool with my Outlook called Zobni, which is a plugin for Outlook that helps aggregate your contacts. And one of the things it does is it pulls in information from both Facebook and LinkedIn, so that when I look at an email address, it'll pull up the profile picture from either LinkedIn or Facebook. And suddenly I have these two personas linked together under the same contact information. And it's sometimes really interesting seeing what sort of profiles that are also linked to their business email. It's an Outlook plugin called Zobni, X-O-B-N-I, inbox spelled backwards. And so it'll allow me to see quite a lot of information about my email behavior and who has contacted me and who they're linked to, etc. But it also aggregates these ideas into one quick and easy place. So people's ability to try to keep those personas separate is definitely breaking down.
Yeah, I think it is. At some point, will break down. I think so. For that reason, everybody can aggregate all of it. You know, here, this is who he is on LinkedIn, and all the feeds can go from one to the other. So on LinkedIn, I can have my Twitter feed go directly to LinkedIn. I do the same, actually, on my website. I have my Twitter feed on my website. On Facebook, I might have a little more that I can put out there, but for the most part, the communication that I have is pretty concise, and Facebook for me is personal, Twitter for me is business, LinkedIn is business, so I do keep the sorts of topics at least separated out. Personality, the brand personality, I don't think I do as good a job as maybe Nick and Jose, you do, in keeping those personas separate.
They're very intentional about where their thought leadership focus is. We've touched upon a lot of issues that are discussed in other communities. These issues are discussed almost weekly in the public relations Twitter chat, the social media Twitter chat, and really one thing that we haven't touched upon is how companies are dealing with these issues, specifically in developing product, but also in recognizing how their audience and customers are relating to the content that the companies are putting out.
And in addition, the product itself.
Yes.
People will relate to the product and then share with each other, which is a very different aspect to what we're talking about, but strongly related.
Yes, Lynn, you will have to come back.
I would love to.
But this was definitely a great intro to the subject.
My 3-year-old knows how to use the iPad very, very well.
And my 14-year-old sets mine up for me since I'm like, you know, this will take you 2 seconds, it'll take me an hour. She'll get it all set up, but ringtones and whatever else. Thank you very much for having me, Cindy. I would love to come back and carry on the conversation. It was wonderful meeting you, Adrian and Nick.
Same here. And, you know, the next time, it would be really great to talk more on neuroscience and how that affects product development.
Yeah, design and product development.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for joining us today, Lynn. Thank you again for joining the Global Product Management Talk. Please follow us at www.blogtalkradio.com/PRODMGMTTALK, where you will get an update weekly on who our upcoming speaker is and what our time and date will be, as we are now being very agile when we are recording to accommodate all different time zones. And thank you again to the AIPMM, the Association of International Product Marketing and Management, for sponsoring us. Sponsorships are available for everyone who wants to reach our audience of product management, product marketing, and product professionals interested in staying up with trends and hot topics regarding product management issues. Follow our tweet at Prod Management Talk for more information. Also, please join the webinar. This Friday, we will be covering it with Tweet. It is How to Accelerate Your Product Management Career by the AIPMM. Thank you again, Lynn. Delighted to have you, Adrian, and Nick.
Pleasure. Excellent. Speak to you next week.
Excellent. Okay. Thank you.